We appreciate Brother Brent for an excellent presentation. And now, just as before, it's an opportunity for you to ask questions, to push back with challenges if you feel inclined to do so, as we did previously. If Bart has some particular questions, then we'll give opportunity for him to engage Brent. But all brothers in the congregation here, in the assembly here, are welcome to ask questions. Just raise your hand and we'll get the microphone to you. Let's go to Bart Shaw first. Bart Shaw.
Thank you, brother. That was a masterful presentation. You're a wonderful speaker. And I just wanted to say I am not a uniformitarian proponent. I think you have to define the flood as a catastrophic event. And so anyone who believes in a global flood is obviously someone who believes in a catastrophic model. So that was probably my main issue that I have with your characterization of my position. But I agree with a lot of what you said. Leviticus 17, life is in the blood. You know, there is a point where the life leaves the body. Would you agree to that? So I deal with it all the time. Someone is dead, and their blood may still be liquid. It may be a solid, but the life is not in the blood at that point. So that would be the point I would make about that, that there is blood can exist in a state where there is no life. And so that would be the argument I would make for the soft tissue that was present in Mary Schweitzer's findings. The life wasn't ever there. Even though blood was created, the creature was already dead. Do you have any further comment? What exactly was the point?
I think in your analogy, I think it's a good analogy, that we have remnants of blood, and the creature, whatever it is, not be living. But in this case, the point is just that. It formerly lived. That's my conclusion of the matter, is that it wasn't created, blood wasn't created without a living thing. That would be my difference of view on that. And of course, that's what I noted, is you can have the same evidence, have a very different take on that. I do think it would be very challenging, very difficult to deny that we see living animation in a lot of these examples, but they're in a fossil record, as old as the dinosaurs and even more ancient. So the real question is did God literally create animation as apparent but not real? For some people would go to the point of saying, well, that's the case of the stars. The stars were a case where literally they were created and given the look of animation, because we have light that we can already see, even though they're billions of light years away. My answer to that particular point is that in the Genesis account, it says God created light. It didn't say one source of light. It said light in general. And my understanding of that is all light was created. Light is a thing. You know, it's a wave energy, it's created. So I think literally in the account of the Genesis account, those stars, yes, were created later on another day, but the light was created first to represent those things, and then those things came into existence. Now, of course, how would you test that? There's an astronomy question that I can't answer and nobody else can answer. But I do believe there is essence of that answer there in the scriptures. As regarding your uniformitarian view, I appreciate that you clarified that. I did read things where some did take a uniformitarian approach. That's why I asked about the evolution earlier, because some people do think there's a little bit of evolutionary process in some of the things that I read, and I'm glad you clarified that for your perspective. So there are, I guess, some differences of views even from that approach, and so that's something to keep in mind for those that are reading the other materials.
My leader, Kenny?
Lyell was mentioned. Isn't he the one that gave us all these layers and the dates?
He didn't give us any dates. He's the one that proposed uniformitarianism. He said...
Well, okay, then let's go with that. If these layers came one upon another, where'd they come from? If it wasn't catastrophism.
So if you're looking at it from Charles Lyell's perspective...
The onion skin thing.
Yeah, if you're looking from his perspective, then you're looking at all the layers and you're thinking, okay, how fast are processes happening today? And he was a naturalist, so he made observations, like many naturalists in the day.
Stardust.
He saw deposition was not happening very fast. Couldn't be something that could happen in hundreds, if not thousands of years. So that's when he started contemplating millions of years. I don't think they got to billions of years until much later when they realized they needed even more time, especially for the evolutionary process. But that's how he would perceive it. And that's how uniformitarian view is looked at, is the present is the key to the past, and how do you stack things afterwards.
Don't they view or date the rocks by the fossils and the fossils then by the rocks?
Yes, and also
Will they date a fossil if you don't tell them what strata it came from?
Dating a fossil is an intriguing idea, because remember, it could be permineralized. Now, in the case of the preservation, you can carbon date it. Carbon dating is only good out to 80 to 100,000 years. But we only have actual grounded datum only back to 4,000 years, 5,000 years possibly, using tree rings and things of that nature. So everything else is extrapolated, it's assumed. And so a lot of assumptions are built into that, and there's a lot of processes. But dating the fossil, remember, if it's permineralized, it went through alteration. So what you're trying to date is the ancient waters and all the minerals that were dissolved that created it, and that will be a very difficult process.
For the sake of order and the recording, please do not talk over one another. Let the person finish before you continue speaking. Let's go first to Matt Kudernick, and then I'll move on.
I have a scientific and a scriptural question. I'll go scientific first, since it was just addressed. You said carbon dating was accurate up to, what did you say, 80 to 100,000 years.
Correct.
So let's say it is accurate up to 100,000 years or even 8,000 years. Can that be used to justify the Earth being older than what would be proposed by either you or Brother Bart?
So if we get into carbon dating and all the other dating methods, we're going to be here a really long time this evening. But let me put it to you this way. When you look at isotopic data, it tells you a lot. And when you look at isotopes, some are radioactive, some are not. In fact, radioactive decay is ultimately compared to C14, which is unstable radioactive, and then you have C12, which is the most stable. The radioactive decay and the stable form are assumed to be at some equilibrium at the time of death for that material. And so what happens is they're already making a huge assumption that they know in the past what were the conditions at the time of death, and then extrapolating off that idea or that model. Now, of course, things have changed. UV radiation, the processes in the ground during the burial and during that fossilization process. There are a lot of things that can take place in that. But one thing that's usually discounted is, even though they want to use half-life, the 5,730 years for half-life of the carbon-14, I've actually worked with the stable forms of isotopes and using them for looking at and understanding maturity of various fossil fuels and things of that nature, oil, gas, and so forth. The thing that isn't really described and everybody spends their time on is talking about the radiometric dating element, which is the C14. The C12 and C13 are always changing. We see it's what helps to characterize these different formations, and based on their maturity, how they've been pressurized, how they've been heated, what has ultimately migrated through these rocks during a certain time, changes those ratios, therefore it's changing those numbers. So even if you change, if you know the C14 really well, C12 can be changing over here all the time, which is changing the ratio and therefore the dating process. And there's a lot of things that go into that dating process that most people aren't aware of, and they are complex. They make a lot of models and build a lot of assumptions into those things. But if you don't tell them what is there, I was asked by Brother Myron a minute ago, if you don't tell them what's there, typically nowadays the lab will just refuse to run the test. They want a geologic formation so they can know what range they're working in. But if you gave them a blind, and a blind test, which is something the RAIT project did under Steve Austin, they were able to pull off getting some samples. And of course, there is huge disparity in those values, and that was proven years ago.
Most of that went over my head, so maybe we can talk about it later, but I appreciate you addressing it anyway. The second is about 1 Corinthians 14 and the context therein. If we're going to use something like God is not the author of confusion from a passage that is exclusively about what takes place during a church service and the use of spiritual gifts like prophesying and speaking in tongues, can we take a passage like that and an excerpt from that passage and use it to talk about something like creation?
So I could ask a question in return. I could ask it, since it only deals with worship, does that open up the door for God to be one who creates confusion? And I don't think the premise of the scripture would support that. I think we're looking at, I'm using the verse as a precedent. It's also a hierarching idea that goes throughout the entire scriptures. I don't believe God intends to be confusing, or else how can we ever get to intellectual decisions to ultimately walk by faith? Right? Faith is built upon the idea of certain evidence, sometimes indirect. Maybe we don't have a direct evidence. But if there is no correlation between the direct and the indirect, it is confusing. For instance, if we don't have clear relationships in the scriptures of how to worship, such as around the communion table, if we're not able to intellectually describe, understand, and defend those positions, such as even 2 Timothy 3:16 and 7 tells us how we get to doing works of faith, then how are we ever going to be able to understand the things that are needful in our Christian aspects of worship and obeying the gospel and so forth? So I would say the overarching idea is, yes, that is a passage about worship, but in the context of the scriptures, God is not an author of confusing things, let alone lies. I think that's Satan, and he's the one that wants to confuse us. That's why you get atheism and you get evolutionary beliefs.
Let's go to Noah Howard.
Brother, thanks so much for your insight on this topic. My question just kind of has to do with connecting the dots, so to speak. So according to this model, a fossil is an example of something that was once living, but is not in the present. So if we take, for example, dinosaurs, an example of a dinosaur fossil, it shows a dinosaur lived at one point. But of course, today we don't have dinosaurs walking around. So, what do you think is the best hypothesis for where these dinosaurs went? Were they completely wiped out by the flood? Did they maybe continue for a little bit after the flood and then disappeared? Or is there a better explanation?
So again, that goes back to, there's a lot of unknowns to that. We can hypothesize. There are a few, I think, hints in the scriptures. I believe there's a passage, I can't remember which one it is off the top of my head. I can't remember if it's Isaiah 55 or which one it is, but it talks about Leviathan. And in the case of Leviathan, it literally talks about it as meat, or it is a food supply for people. And of course, you think about going out and being gatherers. You know, what would you rather gather? A whole day of trying to fish, or trying to go out and actually hunt down one large animal? And I think even in today's world, there's a lot of individuals that are out hunting the mighty game. I think that's been a human tendency. So if they were alive, I would think that either they could have been killed, and that passage may be suggesting that idea, or they simply just fainted away and died, or conditions changed. I mean, we just don't know. We have a huge globe out there. We don't know what they did migration-wise. We don't know anything. And so there's a lot of questions, you know. Look at what Darwin discovered on the Galapagos Islands. I don't think that was necessarily something people anticipated, but when it was, it left a lot of questions. And that's what opened the door for evolution. Since we don't know those answers, how animals like the kangaroo got to Australia, we just don't know how to answer a lot of those things, and it makes it very difficult. And that's what I think Mark talked about earlier, is the idea of faith. There is truly a huge element of faith in all of this.
We'll do Mark real quick. Okay. Mark first, then Mark.
I enjoyed that, Brent. So, just for clarification, when you're talking earlier, you would show a slide and you would say, this is talking about something 500 million years old, half a billion years. You're talking about, as a uniformitarianist would date it,
using the geologic column elements going all the way back to the life expansion of the Cambrian, just to give us context.
But you believe formations. But you believe that catastrophism,
I believe in a catastrophe,
changes all that.
Right. I think that, and also numerous assumptions that have been stacked in going towards the dating methods and things of that nature, and also the interpretive elements of the geologic column as well.
Yeah.
Mark?
So back to this 1 Corinthians 14, God not the author of confusion. Do you believe that God is the author of delusion? Based on 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, where the scripture says that God will send strong delusion. So, you know, I know that's a loaded question, but that's my position. So my counter to your 1 Corinthians 14, God isn't confusing anybody, is if you reject God, if you reject the clear nature of the universe, I mean, it's obvious that God created beauty and wonder and majesty, then you are open to delusion. And Brother Brandon pointed out that God doesn't do that miraculously, but he does allow, you know, the apostate church is what that verse, you know, if we're going to keep it in context, that's the apostate church. And God has allowed that. And that is delusion that has sucked many people down to destruction. And so my counterpoint to your argument is, it's not that God's confusing people who are sincerely seeking the truth. This is not the issue. The issue is people are wickedly searching for another answer, and that they are finding in the paleontologic record their answer. Their delusion is what they're finding. Anyway, just thought I'd clarify.
Any other questions or comments? Confessions or criticisms?
There, you find most of the fossils in the sedimentary rock. Is that true? Or all of them?
All fossils, by definition, would be found in. So, we did see a case of an igneous, which was an ash bed with footprints upon it. Usually you're not going to find it because it's molten lava or some igneous intrusion body. But in the case of an ash flow, yes, we did see cast and impression fossil footprints and the casted bodies. That would have been in a volcanic or igneous layer.
But they're
most of them are in a sedimentary layer, for sure, yes.
Just a very brief comment. I do think that for whatever it's worth, I'm not exactly sure how it fits here, but when the Bible says God is not the author of confusion, it's true, as Matt pointed out, that contextually that's talking about worship. However, when you're talking about something else, God doesn't become the author of confusion. It's a general principle. God is never the author of confusion. And in that particular case, it's used in reference to worship. But I wanted to ask you a question. Bart said earlier that there are no examples of human fossils in the same mass burial places as dinosaur fossils. But if everyone was running from the flood or washed away in the flood, it seems like there would be examples of that. I wondered what your response to that might be.
So when I think about this in a geologic model context, you know, typically what you're going to find is things are going to wash into basins, right? If you've got massive water flow based on both rainfall, and then of course you've got the fountains of the deep that are being expelled, then how that in the deep ultimately affects, and it's obviously going to be some churning factor, is a lot of turbidity, I would assume. That would explain a lot about the sediments, but as far as the fossils of the animals and the plant life, I would assume a lot of it washed into basins, or that these animals were simply just buried in place wherever they might have been at the time. And of course, if you don't have human cohabitation with dinosaurs, then we would expect them to be in different places. But part of it is too, is that there is just a simple buoyancy difference between large animals such as dinosaurs as well as humans. Obviously, it would depend on if one can bloat and float, might be a way to think about it. You know, it's not a pretty picture, but human beings do that. There's a lot of things that I can think about. But again, even what Brandon commented about is, you know, what we saw in the picture, there's a lot of marine fossils, tons of marine fossils. And then we find a lot of other types of fossils that are very dominant in the fossil record, but most are marine. Find the animal type fossils. Usually you find them in particular areas. You will not find them continuously across the formation, even if you could chase it hundreds of miles. You're going to find it in local depositions, and typically they're going to be pocketed depositions. So if I was to go out to an outcrop here, and I expected to find certain kinds of fossils, that would be dominant of this rock outcrop in this location. It may not be the same if I move laterally. That's why fossil hunters spend so much time looking for the most precious of the fossils, because they're not easy to find, and they are fairly randomized comparative to the other things we look for.
Roger Boone, back on the back row.
Thank you. This may not be fair. It's probably not fair. But, and so if you don't want to do this, don't do it. Okay. But I think this is kind of crucial to the whole little thing to me. In Genesis chapter 8, verses, we could say 15 through 17, with the crucial idea being the end of verse 17, that on the ark, or after the flood, God spoke to Noah, "Get out of the ark, you and your wife and your sons' wives with you. Bring out with you every living thing of all flesh that is with you, birds and cattle and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, so that they may abound on the earth and be fruitful and multiply on the earth." I think we've had one explanation of that so far this evening. I was wondering if you maybe, this is what it's not fair to ask you to, is there another understanding of that verse, especially the end of verse 17, that you would hazard, you know, off the top of your head?
Can you explain it? Can you ask the question in a slightly different way so I can understand it a little bit better?
Well, it seems like, and Bart can answer, am I wrong or right? He can help me with this. That this verse was crucial in saying that if dinosaurs were on the ark and they all died out, then God was a liar, because they were supposed to come out of off the ark and abound on the ark and be fruitful and multiply on the ark. So this verse, if they grew extinct, if dinosaurs as a whole kind grew extinct, then this verse makes God a liar. Is that right, Bart? I mean, I don't want to misrepresent it.
I would say we make God a liar. It introduces a contradiction that, you know, that we have to look at to try to explain.
So I'm saying we have had one explanation of this verse. Is there another explanation that might be different?
Okay. First of all, just so we capture on audio, is Bart stated that this would just simply be a contradiction. Doesn't necessarily make God a liar. I think the element, there's a couple things to think about. Number one, who is that command given to? And we see immediately thereafter the fulfillment of that, which is man was fruitful, multiplied, and expanded. You see in the days of Peleg. That is not continental drift or things like that that some people have actually heard try to use that verse to explain, but it's the expansion of people, human race. So to me, the context is the human race. But it's not also to say that dinosaurs did multiply and that were flourishing in certain areas. We just don't know. That's back to the things we don't have as understanding, we don't have as revealed. But whatever the case is, if these were dinosaur-like creatures described in Job 40 and 41, then in that case, Job had to have seen them, because whatever it is that's in this case, if you take the literal approach like I do, then whatever it is God is pointing out of his creation is something little that he can see, so he had to have some experience with them. It didn't have to be them all, it just had to be some. But like I said, it's really a point of, we don't know how things dispersed from the ark. We don't know if some things stuck around, some things left. We do know there's a lot of creative things going on that's hard to explain. Like we talked about the olive branch. We talked about, I don't think the earth was one big muddy form and nasty look at it. Noah gets a vineyard growing pretty quickly. There's obviously the ability to sustain life and all that populated afterwards. So there's just simply things we don't know. And that's the challenge. And leaves us all scratching our heads. We would love to know, but we just don't get that insight. Even though we dig through the scriptures and try to find little insights, there's just not enough there to piece all that together.
Roger,
yeah, I'm going there.
All right. So it's about in. One more.
Somebody else has. You got a mic? SPF 40 is wearing off in front of your
house. Brother, do you have some closing comments?
I will make one closing comment, and then I'll let Bart make a closing comment if he wishes to do so. Again, we want to thank everybody for this opportunity. Thank the congregation and allowing this kind of format. It's a little different. And I did have some comments going, I can't believe you guys are going to share opposing views. Number one, they're not central to the salvation question. I do think there's some things that are critical to how we look at some of these things, how we talk about them. And the number one thing that Bart and I talk about all the time is, look, we're trying to help promote young minds to get out there, get educations, help us. You know, there's just few of us that really have these opportunities to do this. And the church is small and we don't have a lot of active people. One thing I'd love to do is start trying to promote, and we've talked about this too, is doing some workshops with people who are very interested in these kinds of topics and can contribute to some of these things and inspire young people to get involved. But, you know, don't be afraid to go out there and get an education, number one. And number two, when you get in these difficult situations, you know, I think for Bart and I, we can both say is that sometimes you need to reach out to people and look for answers. Doesn't mean that you just simply get satisfied with whatever answer you get. You look at all of the answers, you weigh them, you consider them, you search the scriptures diligently, you keep an open mind. You also understand that sometimes you don't get the answers in your first few years of looking into this stuff. It takes decades to formulate some of these ideas, and we'll be thinking about them for decades to go. I mean, we're not to where we have all these answers, and it's not something I'm going to spend all of my time trying to figure out. I know apologists out there like Ken Hams and others who spend their whole life trying to prove creation science. I don't necessarily look at myself as a creation scientist. I am a Christian scientist. Those are two different things. I use my scientific side to help bring, I hope, some value to some of these discussions, just as preachers who spent many years digging into the Greek and the Hebrew can help add value to my understanding of the Bible and others as well. We all can add some value, and we ultimately together work collectively to, as I said, iron sharpening iron. We're trying to help ourselves understand it, but we're also trying to establish credibility. And I know that was some of the fears of us sharing opposing views was what would happen to credibility. Well, the credibility is that we're open and we're honest and we're sharing our views and we're trying to be courageous enough to share them even if people don't agree with us. So that we can get your feedback, so that we can think even harder about these things, and we can inspire other minds to dig deep to help us understand some of these things. But the main thing is so that our young people do not come up learning things about the church and maybe potentially learn archaic things that are out of context that aren't scientifically sound, such as a geocentric universe, such as the earth is flat. And then they put themselves in a situation that they hear these kinds of things because that's what the Bible teaches. And then they go to school and they learn something else. And what do? They ultimately look at who's more credible, and we lose the credibility. So we're trying to help establish and build credibility and help them in answering questions that ultimately they're going to ask when they go through the school system. It's getting harder every day. And one thing I always say about evolutionary theory, it's always evolving. It's never staying put. It is changing all the time. And it's hard to keep up with it all. So we need young people who are literally getting it out of the textbooks, hearing it in classrooms, and keeping us apprised of what's going on. And I think it's a real team effort to look at some of this apologetic issues. And there are many of them that we can be examining. So thank you for that. I'll turn it over to Barbie and something to add.
I'll just say my heart is filled with gratitude for you, brother. And I appreciate you so much for all the work you do. Thank you for coming. Sorry you had a car accident. And God bless you. Love you very much.
Thank you very much. Love you, too.